And welcome to the Fanboy Garage. I'm Chris Lasanti, joined by my co-host, Aaron Varola.
Yo, what's up, people? Welcome to episode 61 of the Fanboy Garage. We've got lots to unpack. There have been some crazy trailers. Robert Pattinson breaks his silence. There's been some reviews dropping. So let's get started with the Joker, since that's the one that kind of rocked everyone's minds. So the Joker dropped its second trailer. Comes out October 6th. So it's about a month. About a month out. And I guess this trailer tickled everyone's fancy. Everyone's jumping all over it. Super excited about it. It certainly looks like a very different film. I mean, it's always looked like that, but I think it's certainly showing its colors. And I for one am very excited, even though I wasn't really a big fan of the trailer. Not saying a big fan is the wrong thing to say. I'd say I was already sold on this movie. It didn't really do anything to heighten my excitement for this film, but either way, I'm going to be there October 6th to check it out. Chris, what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of had the same reaction. Like, you said to me, like, well, what do you think? And it's kind of, is it a little underwhelming? And I was like, yeah, but that's fine. Like, I'm perfectly okay with that because, you know, I too was sold on this film the minute that they said Joaquin Phoenix is going to be playing the Joker in a standalone Joker movie. I was like, great, cool. I don't need to find out anything else. I'm good. Yeah. I'm in. I wanted to know, and we'll talk about this in a second. I wanted to know as little as possible going into this movie. So for me, the trailer, while it's not anything that's like, oh my God, that's amazing, it's what it needed to be for me. It lets me know the movie's happening, that it wasn't all a dream, and it lets me know that, and I still don't know much about the movie. I'm really pumped for it. The reviews are, unfortunately, the reviews for this movie are basically out.
Crazy. They screened it because it was on it was at one of the festivals. I think it was at TIFF. Is that right?
Probably.
Toronto International Film Festival. And it got standing ovations.
Yep.
And the reviews are like through the roof.
Mostly, right? Yeah. I mean, there's been a couple, like literally a couple of negative reviews that I saw that unfortunately were less about the movie and were more about issues that the critics had with the social commentary and how they felt like it's kind of hypocritical relative to the type of movie that it is. I have no time for that. That's just silly. To me, you're a film critic. Judge the movie. Overwhelmingly positive. No surprise. I mean, people are saying that Joaquin Phoenix is amazing. They're talking Oscar nominations. I'm not shocked by any of that. That's exactly what I was figuring, hoping anyway. I guess you never know. But that's exactly what I was hoping would happen. Look, this is a meaty role. It looks like it is a true, like, standalone film, right? Which they've been very... And you know what I like about it, too, is the fact that... And I was thinking about this the other day after I watched the trailer. What I really love is that they have stuck to their guns on this. And they have really avoided what I think is the temptation to try and do something to, like, incorporate the Batman elements into the marketing of the film.
Yeah.
And meaning, like, I get it. Batman's not in the movie, but, like, they could have emphasized Gotham City more because that's a name that's, that's synonymous with Batman. They could have used that more. They could have incorporated, like, Wayne's of some, you know what I mean? Like, emphasized.
I mean, he's in the trailer. Bruce Wayne is in, I mean, sorry.
Thomas Bruce.
Thomas Wayne is in the trailer.
But not, I mean, it's not like...
But they didn't like
over
name
the
drop.
Top. Exactly. That's what I mean. So, like, they've really gone out of their way in a very pleasant way to resist the temptation of trying to use the crutch of, you know... I think they realize, too, that, I mean, Joker, everyone gets it, right? They pretty much know who the Joker is at this point. He's as iconic in some ways as Batman is. But, what's nice is that for people who are, the way they're marketing this movie, for people who are, you know, like comic fans and fans of this genre, they get it and they're going to go because it's a Joker film, right? But if you're not necessarily a fan of comics and superheroes or whatever, like, you're watching this really intriguing, fascinating trailer for this movie that looks like a character piece.
Yep.
On a guy who's a little crazy and dresses like a clown, and that happens to be called Joker, and that,
yeah,
with Joaquin Phoenix in it. So, like, if you're just a fan of film and you're a fan of that type of film, you're going to be intrigued by this as well.
Right. Yeah. So, no. Agreed. I mean, it's, you know, it's a, and I've said it, I think I've said this before in previous podcasts as we've talked about this film before, but it feels like Falling Down, that film with, yep, Michael Douglas. And, you know, you're getting kind of beats in that trailer of, like, this dude's just having a really bad day, and ultimately that's kind of what snaps him. Or he's having a rough life, whatever it is. But to your point earlier about the plot and understanding what this film is about, like, I have no idea what this thing is about other than someone is literally losing their mind on screen.
Right.
And I am so, so on board for this ride, because in the small glimpses of, you know, Joaquin Phoenix in his craft, it is amazing to see. So, and again, you know, like, I agree. I think part of this whole thing, I wonder if, you know, as you were saying this, I was kind of actually thinking the opposite when you were saying about everyone kind of knows the Joker. It's an iconic character, but, like, you would not necessarily know any of that until he says it towards the end. Like, I want to come out as Joker.
Right.
And then, you know, if you've never seen the trailer, then you wouldn't have known, or if you're not following any of this stuff, then you don't know. So it kind of blows people's minds when you see that, like, dude with, you know, the makeup and all that stuff, and Joker, and I guess he's living in Gotham. So I wonder how people feel about all of that. And to your point before about there not being really much of a Batman element to any of this, which I'm totally cool with.
Yo, no, I mean, it's necessary because it's obviously not a big part of the movie, but
no.
I think that it very easy for, you know, a studio to want to go down that road of trying to do as much as they can to make it obvious that there's a link. Yeah. And they haven't done that, which is good. And also, you want to be careful, right? Because you don't want to give people a false sense.
You don't
want to
try to connect it to anything either.
Yeah, and you don't want to give people a false sense of what the movie is. Right. You know, you don't want people going to the theater being like, oh, wait, well, where the hell was Batman?
Right.
You know, because that sometimes gives you that negative impression of the movie rather than looking at just the movie that's on the screen. So I think people will have while we don't know exactly what the plot is, we at least have a good idea of what the movie is or isn't. Yep. Right. And I think that's important. And this is an R-rated movie. It's a Joker origin story. That's a side story. It's a standalone thing. Yeah, and for obvious reasons, yes, it's going to be set in Gotham City, and there's going to be stuff like that, just because it is a Joker film.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to do any of those things, then it's almost like, why bother? Because then it's just make up an original story at that point.
Right.
But, yeah.
Do you think, I've heard rumors that it does pop up, but do you think he dons the iconic purple suit, purple jacket?
I don't know. It's possible. Yeah. Sure. I mean, I see, the thing too is we don't know, like, how much of the film we're seeing, right? And I think I mentioned this during the first trailer. Like, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this footage could still be fairly early on.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think we should assume that what we're seeing in these trailers is our elements of, like, the entire film. I still feel like there's a whole lot of film here that we're not seeing.
Yeah.
So is it possible? Sure. I mean, it would. That's one thing that I think you shouldn't want to avoid doing. Like, at some point, like, he should be the Joker, right? Like, mm-hmm. at least some mm-hmm. semblance of the Joker that we know. And even if it's at the very end, that's fine.
Right.
You know. Well, maybe so it happens sooner than that. Maybe, you know, maybe he spends half the film becoming the Joker and half the film as the Joker. We don't know, and that's what's cool about it.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm intrigued, man. I really am, especially, you know, this is Todd Phillips, you know, who's directing this film, who it's kind of, this is not really his thing.
No, not at all.
I mean, he was coming off of A Star Is Born, right? Like, he did that. But, yeah, I mean, all of his other stuff, like Old School, The Hangover, Trilogy, all of those films. So this is totally out of his comfort zone, I'd say. But from what I've seen thus far, it looks great.
Well, and that's what's also
cool
about
reading. Have you been actually been reading the reviews?
You know what?
Shame on you.
No, so I started to read, not so much the reviews. I started to read, like, you know how they give you, like, you'll get articles where they give you, like, little, like, couple sentences from each review. Like, just like the, you know, like, oh, I think it's great. Or, oh, Joaquin Phoenix is amazing. Or, like, that stuff I read through. Then I saw a couple of the negative ones, and I was like, So I did give a couple of those a read just because I wanted to see, like, you know, everyone's praising this thing. So, like, whenever you see something where, like, someone's just completely negative about it, it's like, well, I have to read this just to see where they're coming from. And I started to get a little agitated because I realized where they were coming from, and it wasn't any place, like I said, of any type of film criticism, really.
Yeah.
But then I kind of stopped myself because they weren't really giving details.
Right.
I mean, a little bit, but not like anything like you wouldn't have been able to pick up or kind of already have guessed, right?
Yeah.
Then I stopped at that point. It was like, all right, that's it. Like, I'm not going to read any of the positive reviews because obviously they're positive and I know people think it's great and I fear that those reviews might have more detail.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just been staying away from it at all. Like, I would have preferred the reviews came out a month from now, but you know,
that's
it
crazy.
Is what it is. I mean, but I think I'll be able to avoid
it.
Yeah. And thankfully I think people are avoiding it for the most part. It's not like it's, you know, there's not like a Rotten Tomatoes score yet or anything like that. So they're not all over the place,
mm-hmm.
but on Twitter for a while, like everybody was blowing up posting reviews and whatnot. And that's where I kind of started
staying,
to phase out.
Staying away from it.
Yeah, I was just kind of scrolling past all of that. So,
right. Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, October 6th, around the corner.
Yep.
Same day as, the day after Comic-Con starts, really. Because Comic-Con starts on the 5th.
Yes.
But, yeah, I mean, we have to check it out, obviously.
Yes.
So we'll figure that out, but
ironic how what a difference a year makes. Last year, Venom was opening the weekend of Comic-Con in New York, and now it's Joker. The quality on the film is probably going to be a little different, but they're both in theory they were villain origin stories without the main character that made the villain. You know, that links the villain.
That's so funny,
but very clearly very different quality wise.
That's so funny,
but yeah,
and so true. Very cool. Great. So staying in the world of Gotham in DC, Variety had an interview published today with some video of Robert Pattinson finally breaking his silence on being cast as Batman for Matt Reeves' The Batman. In his interview, he talked quite a bit about what it was like being cast and quite frankly how he was pissed, effing pissed about Scooper's breaking the fact that he was out for the role before he had actually auditioned. Thought for sure, you know, his opportunity to play Batman was dead in the water before he could even get in front of casting folks. But thankfully that didn't happen, and obviously he's the now new Batman. So it was a really cool article to read. You know, they kind of talked about his film The Lighthouse and, you know, his take on the comic book genre, kind of how he stayed in and out of touch with some of that stuff. I guess he had some informational talks at or around the time of Guardians of the Galaxy with Marvel, and obviously that didn't pan out. But one of the main reasons why he was drawn to the character of Batman is because it's his all-time favorite superhero. So, of course, he'd want to play it. Very similar to Andrew Garfield playing Spider-Man. So, yeah, it was like I said, cool article. You know, he talked a little bit about being in the suit and how it felt. So I this movie can't come soon enough. I'm so interested to see what he does with the role.
Yeah, but let's talk for a second about this whole idea of, oh, I'm pissed that Scoopers had me tied to the role, even though before I had a chance to audition for it. I don't buy that. look, you could say what you want about Scoopers,
yeah,
and whatever, and you know, but. And people have a lot to say about them, you know, sometimes rightfully so. But I'm going to call shenanigans on this one because, yeah, you know, Scoopers, especially the ones who got it right, like that, they didn't just wake up one morning and say, yeah, you know what, I'm going to start a rumor that Robert Pattinson, of all people, is going to become right. Batman. Like, clearly, that was already in the works. Now, I mean, is it a matter of semantics, you know, that they knew he was going to come in for the role?
Mm-hmm.
But... and he hadn't yet, but the idea that someone had a scoop that he was going to be Batman before he even was auditioning for the role, that can't be a thing.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody would have guessed. If you had to sit down, right, and said, hey, come up with five people that are could potentially be the new Batman, and you had no idea of who was in the thought process, right, who was in the works, who they had on their list, I don't know that Robert Pattinson would have been one of them.
Yeah.
So yeah. I clearly came from somewhere and something. So I don't buy that at all. But that's what they have to say, I guess. And
yeah,
you know.
He spun. It was an interesting, like, the way he spun it, because he was apparently Googling himself every 5 minutes on a flight to LA to actually do the audition, and he kept on, you know, Googling himself again, refreshing, and lo and behold, who is he sitting next to but Christopher McQuarrie? Which I also find this is so, like, ironic that he's sitting next to Christopher McQuarrie, who apparently has, I don't know if he's had these conversations or not, but was eyeballed for potentially doing something for Superman.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so Pattinson apparently didn't know that it was Christopher McQuarrie. And then so he was, like, super embarrassed because he was Googling himself, and he explained the situation, you know, McQuarrie says, oh, I would have done the same thing. Like, I get it. It's all good, man. What?
Sure. Like,
okay. You just happen to be sitting next to this guy who could have, you know what I mean? Could have directed Superman. What? Okay, man.
Yeah, I think someone's having a little fun with people, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Whatever.
But yeah, like, oh, my team was in a panic. You know,
the fact that he was Googling himself nonstop on a flight to go do an audition should tell you all you need to know about how he might like to see his name out there. So he would have put it past him that he might want to just stir up, you know, stir the pot a little bit to get the name out there. But I mean, look, I just want to see the suit. That's it.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, you said he was trying it on and stuff, right? I would assume
he tried on a suit. I don't know if it's the suit.
Right. Well, he had, I would assume he had to put something on as a part of the audition, right? The prototype, see how he would look in the.
I don't know. I mean, they put people in some, I think, who was it? Bale? When he auditioned, it took screen tests. It was him in the Kilmer suit.
Yeah.
Right. So. And then
so
other
saying
people
that
have been in the Christopher Reeves.
They put Pattinson in the suit from the end of Batman and Robin, like that like
the nipple suit, the Arctic.
Silver, yeah, the Arctic. That'd be amazing. Could you imagine that footage if they did that and those pictures getting out there? The internet would break. It'd be fantastic.
You know what? Honestly, suit they. I wonder if they would have put him in this because he's not as big as Affleck, right? So you can't size him
close,
or put him in that suit.
No,
he
would.
But I would.
Half of
I'd imagine
would
him
in that suit,
in the sort of Dark Knight tactical suit.
Yeah, it would have to be something sleeker. I would think.
Yeah,
yeah. For now, I mean, I'm hoping he bulks up a little bit, but
right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully. He looks like a hot mess, though. At least in the interview.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, he's not...
He's filming... well, I think he may have wrapped the Tenant... Tessent? I don't even... The Nolan film. I think it's Tenant.
Oh, that... Yeah. Is he in that?
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So he apparently found out that he was cast as Batman on his first day of shooting with Christopher Nolan. Again.
Another ironic.
Yeah, you know what
full
I mean?
Full of irony, this Robert Pattinson.
What? Yeah. Dude, you're leaving breadcrumbs, bro.
And Adam West made the phone call to let him know.
Yeah. Jeez. Awesome. But we did get a listener question, right?
Yes, this is a good time. Let's get into Ron Diesel's question. He says, throughout history, from comics to TV, movies, and video games, we've seen entrances to the Batcave. With the new Batman movie, any ideas on what the secret entrance should look like for the new Batman movie?
Before we give our answers, let's kind of go through some of those entrances. I mean, obviously it's a cave, and there's been lots of like car hopping into, or not car hopping. Well, one car hopped, but a lot of cars driving into a waterfall or some hidden entrance.
Well, I hope that they eventually go back to my favorite run, which is, you know, from the 66 show and the movie, where I want them to have to open the, you know, I want the poles to be there with the names on them, Bruce and Dick, so that they know which pole to go down. That's very important. You have to go down the right pole or else you get the wrong outfit, right? When you come out, that'd be bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God. But, you know, that was the really cool thing about that Batman. I know it's not like the top thing, but it was always like that it was in some sort of study behind the bookcase, you know, and they kind of did a little bit of that in the Begins, the Batman Begins and the Dark Knight Rises, where it's like, again, in a study, they play the little keys on the piano and then a bookcase opens up. That was always cool. I have to say though, like the Dark Knight, you didn't really get a lot of, well, there wasn't a cave. So it was like,
cave had been destroyed and it was a basement or whatever. I mean, whatever that was.
Yeah.
But
where?
Yeah. But the, I mean, I joke about the Batman 66 thing, but like you just said, I'm actually partial to it. And I hope that if it is going to be like kind of this noir type vibe, that they do give you like some type of a behind a bookcase, like secret thing, you know, down to like a gothic, like Batcave vibe. Like that's cool, and it's something we haven't seen in a while,
right?
So yeah, that would be my preference.
We
haven't really gotten a lot of the because I don't think it necessarily lends itself to a movie as much. Like, you haven't gotten a lot of the, like, let's show him get down to the Batcave,
right?
Because I think that it also opens the, you know, because don't forget, in Batman 66, the whole idea was like they go down the poles, they would somehow get into their suits on the pole and come down as their alter ego, right? That's clearly not something that's going to happen in a movie. They've gone more the route of like the suit's in the cave and the guy gets down to the cave and puts the suit on. You know, I'm assuming they're going to stick to that whole vibe, but I still would prefer, give me like a bookcase, give me a library, study, something like that, with a little bookcase that they can go down and
I mean, they did some really cool, like, one of the, I'd say you're never going to hear this from me again, but some cool things in the Schumacher films where, like, he's got like a tube, he gets into some like high speed tube, and then, like, you know, the message from Alfred is being, like, you know, projected onto his face and whatever. I thought that was pretty cool.
The only thing is, though, why do you need a high-speed tube? Like, how far are we going exactly?
I mean, if he was at Wayne Enterprises. Remember where that happened? It was, like, in his office and, like, the seat, ducted. That's dope.
But you wouldn't want that in a Batcave, though. Like, I mean, in your Wayne Manor, right? Going to the Batcave?
You don't need you wouldn't need it in Wayne Manor, but just the entrance would be pretty. I think that's pretty sweet. I forgot the one. It may be the same one where it was like a spiked. This may have even been the Keaton films. It was like an Iron Maiden. He gets in there, and like the spikes go away, And then he kind of gets dropped down into the thing.
Iron Maidens are cool.
Yeah.
Should be an Iron Maiden in every movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's all types of... I even think it was... maybe it was Returns where, like, the switch was inside of a fish tank.
Yeah, is now that... you're getting a little... I mean, to me...
Dude, I thought you were, like, a big Batman
no,
fan.
No, I'm just saying I don't know that I need that stuff.
None of the, like, you know, it's hidden. The switch is hidden in plain sight.
But I don't think we're going that route. Like, I don't think we're going to... Yeah.
I'd like this Batman to spend a little bit more time... in the Batcave.
No, I definitely agree with. He should.
Because that, like, doesn't happen anymore.
And everything in the Batcave should be labeled, like in Batman 66, like with on-the-nose references.
Like the bat shark repellent?
Yeah. Well, yeah, a bat computer. It should say bat computer.
Yeah.
In case you were wondering. But, no, yeah, there should be more Batcave stuff because that would lend itself to the detective element, which is what I'm hoping they do.
Yeah.
But what I don't
sit
think
in
they're
the
gonna,
bat chair.
I don't see
a
lot. Yeah, I don't see a lot of people... being around Wayne Manor, thus to necessitate like the need to hide the switch to the Batcave in a fish tank or, you know, in a statue or whatever.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't
so
think we need
like
that.
What just pulls a book, and then the book open. You know,
yeah,
book
I don't even
open.
Know that you necessarily need that. Yeah, why not? Sure, pull a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
I hit a button. It doesn't even have to be that, you know.
Yeah, it like puts a pen in a different spot.
Yeah, sure.
I want to see some of that cool stuff, man. Where it open, you know, where he's like in there. He's doing some stuff.
No, yeah, I definitely want that.
I think we need that. I mean, it was cool to see it in BVS a bit.
Yeah,
you know, with Alfred, yeah. Like, you know, taking over the. I don't even know what I'm going to say the bat plane and helping out, but like, oh, and then, you know, obviously he's training in there.
Yep.
Well, training.
There
place.
Was cool Batcave stuff in Justice League. Yeah. I mean, I liked that vibe too, that they were going for, but I mean, yeah. All the Batman stuff in that was good. Yeah. That stuff was really cool.
Never got a Fortress of Solitude though.
We didn't.
Mm. Mm.
But it's all right.
So,
we might have eventually.
I mean, so, yeah, Cave, cool. You know, obviously he's got to get the Batmobile in and out of the damn thing. So,
yep.
however they
and
do
whether
that.
Whether they decide to, right, show us that.
You know, like it felt like the animated series, the Batman animated series kind of took, obviously it was heavily inspired by the Burton film.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like this mountainside, this in Wayne Manor sits on top of a mountain kind of thing. So he had like a long road.
Yeah.
Which I never got. I was like, man, Batman is like tearing up those corners, man, to get his Batmobile.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing the animated series did was that it had because it was going for like a timeless quality.
Mm-hmm.
So like it would have, you know, like they were black and white TVs, but like there were computers.
Right.
But
yeah.
They were like the computers were obviously a little bit more primitive and things like that. So like there were things that were out of place and didn't make sense, but that's because they wanted like that timelessness to it.
Yeah.
Whatever would fit the vibe that they were going for. And that's sort of what I hope. I don't expect them to have black and white TVs or things like that, but I would hope that they would go for more of a timeless look in this movie. You know, people were talking about Superman Returns on Twitter last week, and yeah, I know. We're not going to talk too much about that, but the one thing that I did like about Superman Returns, I didn't like much of it, but the one thing I did like was I love the timeless look of the film.
Yeah.
And,
people still wear trench coats.
Yeah, it just has a kind of an oddly out of place, timeless quality to it. And I have always wanted to see a Batman film, like modern day, that had that kind of a vibe, where it's sort of timeless quality to it, where you can't quite fit exactly when it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like, is it now? Is it not? I mean, I guess to a point, Burton, the 89, Batman 89 had that vibe going for it too.
Yeah. I mean, everything from like the suit to the computers there too, were also
I mean, it was also 89, so right. Naturally technology wasn't, you know, then wasn't what it was now. So any, just the idea of a computer was cool in 1989.
Right.
It didn't have to be anything right. fancy. But I wouldn't mind, yeah, having that type of a more timeless feel would be cool.
The one interesting thing that you bring up, though, about Superman Returns is that in 1977, when you put someone in a trench coat and a top hat or a hat, it kind of worked. Well, it worked, right? Obviously, it's the 70s. I think people still dressed kind of like that. And they didn't change any of it, right? So, yeah, I see your points. This is like, it's totally weird. I don't know why that worked, but I agree with you. On to the next one, because I don't want to talk about Superman Returns. Right. Crap.
So what you do want to talk about, though, is the fact that you saw The Dark Crystal, right?
Yes, I did. Completed it all. 10 episodes, 10 hours of my time, and they're complete, like, full-on hours, episodes. It's beautiful. It's a masterpiece, in my opinion. They do some amazing. Well, let's first talk about the plot a bit. I think it was smart to do a prequel. There was a lot to dig into. There's a lot of mythology here that they have to unpack. And they just it was like Lord of the Rings. Yeah, it was like Lord of the Rings meets Game of Thrones in a Jim Henson world. Like, it was dope.
You talking about the plot? Is that?
No, well, yeah, no, the plot has a little bit of the Game of Thrones because you've got, like, different Gelfling clans and stuff like that, and they all basically bow down to one leader, but they all have, like, their own little separate queens, or madras is what they call them, okay. But they're queens, and they all have to, obviously, like, they all contribute to this one higher queen. So there's a lot of intrigue there because, you know, they hear rumors that Skeksis are essentially the spoilers, guys. but no surprise, that are draining Gelflings. And so there's like this infighting that happens. Honestly, if you haven't seen it, like, you got to see it because it's a really, really, like, you got to put all up, like, oh, it's a puppet. And the fact that they're using puppets and doing this thing, puppets, like, and enhancing it with CGI, like, there were a lot of places and cases where I couldn't tell what was a puppet and what was CGI. Obviously there's a lot of the creature work that they've done with the puppetry, and it's phenomenal and looks really good. But they just further enhance things, like a tongue, for example. Like, when one of the puppets is speaking, they animated the tongue to actually, instead of it just being like a mouth moving up and down, like, the tongue actually moves. It's really, really cool stuff. Couldn't recommend it enough. It's a 10 in my book. It was great.
So now, obviously, as we've mentioned here before, I've never seen The Dark Crystal, the movie.
Come on over.
So you've been trying to get me to come over. But now, this thing is a prequel.
Right.
So do I necessarily, can I watch this without having seen the original?
You can.
Okay.
Yeah, you can. It's, yeah. Yeah, no, because the thing is, actually, I'd be interested to see your take or hear your take on watching this first and then watching Dark Crystal. Because for me, having already seen The Dark Crystal, that I'm like, there's a lot of things that they kind of got to tie up. Like, because once you start down this prequel path, I know how this thing ends, and I know bits and pieces of the story from what's being told to you in The Dark Crystal movie.
Right.
So I'm like, they got to line some of this stuff up, which I think is probably the hardest part of it all. But they do a great job. It moves flawlessly. And in fact, they could probably do a second season. So, okay.
So this was meant to originally to be a standalone, like, story.
I think, I mean, the amount of work that's gone into this thing.
Yes.
I'd imagine so. I mean, they could end it, but there's still enough time. There's still a bit, like, enough gap to, like, create some more stuff. But ultimately, it's ending with the Dark Crystal, right? So
does it capture So that's like any prequel, right? You have the flexibility of like, do I need to take it right up to the point that we get to the Dark Crystal, or can we like and still give, or do we want to leave room to give more of the prequel story, or does it capture the like the essence and the vibe of the movie? Like, do you feel like you're watching when you watch this? Obviously, a lot of years have passed, right? Since the movie came out. Do you feel like in 2019 you were watching like a Dark Crystal show? Like, did it feel like it? You watch 100%. Star Wars things now, right? It still feels like Star Wars.
Yeah.
That, I guess, is kind of like what I'm getting at.
I mean, everything is there. It feels bigger. You know, I think, and that's the beautiful thing about doing a prequel, is because a lot of where the movie starts is in this sort of age of darkness, and things have, you know, have died off, and there isn't many of those things, but they kind of leave things vague. So when you step into this world again, it's a lot bigger. It's a lot brighter. There's a lot more of different characters. So you get a better understanding of, you know, why certain characters are the way that they are, and sort of the way that life was before the Dark Crystal movie, which is fascinating, because a lot of, like I said, the creature work is top notch and the puppetry is top notch, but like, they had to create new stuff, right? You know, and it fits in the world, like seamlessly fits. It's a lot of cool stuff. I wouldn't say that it relied heavily on fan service, like the nudge, wink, winks, like, haha, we got you there kind of things. Like, it did a great job at feeling very natural to the movie. And again, it stitched itself well. But, you know, if there's anything that I would say, this is a very small critique of the series, is that everything looked really new. Because it is.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure,
like, you know, the Dark Crystal was filmed in 1982. It was a love project, passion project for Jim Henson and Frank Oz, who directed the film, co-directed the film together. And this is obviously, it's been digitally refreshed. This show has been digitally released. So there's a cleanness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, you know, the Dark Crystal movie, there is like this grain, this filth to it. And it could be just the way, I don't know how this series was shot, if it was shot digitally or on film. I'm going to guess digitally. And that comes across. The film grain is lost. So everything looks very smooth. That's the only thing that really bothers me.
Okay.
But the articulation and like the advancement in puppetry is like, nuts. Cool. And the voice work is great.
All right. So now I've seen some people talking about it. It'd be interesting to see if this leads to more. I mean, I know you mentioned maybe a second season. Maybe it leads to I guess you technically don't have to have a second season, right? You can just make another, another season, or another series.
Yeah, another series, like True Detective.
Yeah, you could do that.
Yeah.
Or does it maybe spark interest in maybe they do a movie, you think?
I don't see, maybe. I just think the amount of time, like having 10 hours of this world was a treat. And I would much prefer some more of that, because there are some questions that were left unanswered.
Okay.
In the movie, I mean in the show. So, they could do a better job, I think.
I mean, you never know with this stuff, especially with Netflix right now. They're a little unstable.
They need the content.
But they do need content, and like I said, I've heard people or seen people talking about this, so. You know, this might be something that they can hang their hats on. You know, like, they don't have the Marvel shows anymore. So, like, it helps to have some of this genre stuff, you know, that will bring that audience to the table. So yeah, maybe they do continue on in some form.
Yeah. It was awesome. So I hope so.
The only problem is things like that take, I mean, as years. I know, so I was a fan of Farscape, which, you know, used the Jim Henson, like, studios puppets and whatnot.
Yeah.
But not for, like, not every character.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of characters. But even then, like, the amount of work involved.
Oh, my God.
You know,
I mean, dude, this was announced in 2017.
Yeah. So,
you know, and it shows, though. I mean, there's a lot of love that went into the creation of these characters and expanding the lore and the mythology of Thra, you know, which is the world that they live in. Uh-huh. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was done before, you know, like comics and things like that to kind of help fill in the gaps after the movie was released. But this is stunning. Right. And I highly recommend
as somebody who is still, you know, planning on watching the movie and the series, I'll ask one more question. I asked if I need to see the movie, if I can watch this before the movie, and you said yes. Mm-hmm. But now, if I watch this before the movie, do you think
that it'll diminish?
Yes. Do I? Am I better off watching the movie first, just because it did come out in 1982?
Yeah.
And I'm gonna watch this thing, which is like, you know, you're talking it up as being this like visual masterpiece. Will that be a little disappointing if I watch? Because you're coming from the perspective of you've seen that, you love the movie,
yeah,
you've seen it,
yeah,
a million times, and now you're watching this and it's like, oh my God, this is like the Dark Crystal in 2019.
Yeah.
Will I have the opposite effect on me if I, you know, haven't seen the movie? If I watch the movie afterward, will I be like, oh? So
yeah, I mean, that's a good point. There's one thing that I've always recognized in watching The Dark Crystal that I thought was amazing, very, very smart. And they do a little bit of it in the show. And I do think if you were to see the show first, it would just be, oh, okay, that's cool. And when you see it in the movie, like, remembering that the movie was made in 1982 and that they were doing this kind of filming.
Right.
The way I'll explain it to you is that the character Jen in the Dark Crystal movie is obviously a puppet, but they do these wide shots where they actually put somebody in a costume to have him move or climb a rock or something like that. Right. And they do this pretty seamlessly. So, like, you know, close up of Jen's face, the puppet, and then they kind of pan back and, you know, he's now running and it's a person, a very skinny, small person, but, you know, and in the costume, and it looks awesome. Well, they do kind of some of that in the show, and I was kind of like, oh, that's cool that they're bringing it back. But, like, you know, again, the process in which, you know, Henson and Oz kind of put these kind of scenes together back then was, like, to me, cutting edge, really thoughtful filmmaking. And so when you see it done in 2019, you're like, oh, of course they would do that like that. But, like, back in 1982, you know, when he was really, you know, just maybe 20 years into the puppetry stuff and making his first, like, you know, feature film, that's a big deal. So it's like stuff like that I appreciate from the film, and so maybe you should watch the film first.
Okay, maybe I'll do that then.
Yeah. So come on over.
All right.
Sorry, that was a lot of the Dark Crystal, but yeah.
One thing that you're not super excited about, and we probably won't talk this much about it, is the fact that another Terminator, Dark Fate trailer,
yes,
came out, needless to say, it did not generate the buzz that Joker did.
No.
I find myself, like, I was somewhat defiantly trying to be excited about this movie, and it's just not working for me. Like, I just, yeah. I can't, muster up a lot of excitement. The more I see of it, the more I see of the trailers, it looks like another retread of like a very similar plot.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, there's another Terminator that looks cool and has cool effects, but they're still very much like the Terminator 2 effects. Trying to get at them, and it's just, and there's another version of the Arnold, the T, or what, 800, whatever he was, and
right.
It's like, all right, like, I've seen this before.
Yeah, yeah. This is, first of all, I hold Terminator and T2, like, in the highest regards. I can appreciate Rise of the Machines, which is T3. Salvation was a great try, but ultimately I think it was too lofty and just not compelling enough. The story was kind of like BS. But again, I think there are a lot of similarities from all of these films, these attempts at kind of trying to crack the code again, from T2, that they're playing up again in this movie, Dark Fate. And it's kind of like been there, done that, seen that, like, okay, great. Now you're going to have to explain to us again how the T-800 is here and how you managed to convert him into a protector versus a kill, you know, versus a Terminator. Like, in the trailer you show Sarah Connor's distrust in him again, which is kind of like, well, then, I mean, wait, if this is the sequel to T2, like the proper sequel to T2, and they ended on good terms, then why is she reacting the way that she is, right? Oh, wait, and there's some like advanced human that's like integrated themselves with like Terminator technology, and that sounds like Terminator Salvation to me. You know what I mean? Oh, there's like this gooey villain that dresses up like a cop. That sounds like T2. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels like a Frankenstein version of every other film that's come before it. And unfortunately, I don't, you know, I know this feels to me like a play for the foreign markets, like, 'cause they'll eat this stuff up, but I don't think it's going to do very well here. That's just my take. I could be completely wrong. But like I said on Twitter, I mean, when was the last time we had a great Predator movie? Probably not since the first. And T2 is a highly, you know, it's a well-regarded film. It's, you know, highly acclaimed. You can't get better than that. So they should have just left this.
Do you think if this movie doesn't do well, you think this is finally the end?
I hope so. I mean, but I would have thought that Genesis would have ended this thing.
Right.
Well, Genesis was horrible, but I gotta go back through the box office and see how it did internationally.
Not well, but this is the kicker here. So I think what happens is now you're selling the whole idea of, well, James Cameron's back, and, you know, at least as a producer, and you have a good director, right? Or at least, you know, a guy who's, you know, people know, right?
Sure.
Tim Miller. So they're going that route now. You know, Genesis, you could say, all right, well, you know, we took our shot to kind of revamp, reboot the series or whatever. But now we're going to take one more crack with the original guy and bringing in a hot new director and all this stuff and bringing Linda Hamilton back. And if this doesn't work, then I think it has to be the end, because it's like, well, nothing's going to work then. You know,
right.
Your formula
right.
just doesn't work. So,
yeah, I mean,
bringing John Carpenter back as a producer for Halloween worked, right?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, well, it didn't, not creatively, but box office wise, it
sure,
worked. You know,
sure.
So we never know.
Yeah, I mean, so Genesis did what, $350 million at the box office internationally?
That's it. Oh, okay.
And 89.
Yeah, that's
89.7.
Yeah.
Domestic. On a budget that was $155 million, but they had to do it with Alan Taylor, the guy from Game of Thrones,
and
direct that film.
And Thor: The Dark World.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's a winner.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll see. I just, I'm not going to be there opening night. I'm not going to be there at all. Just not. Unless it's like, oh my God, it's the best Terminator film since, you know, this is when I'll start to care about reviews. But yeah, right now it's not doing it for me at all.
Well,
and I think this last trailer basically showed us all of the action sequences.
It's very possible.
Yeah.
Which is never a good sign either when you feel like you need to give away a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean this trailer had a lot of stuff packed into it.
Right. It's the opposite of like the Joker trailer, right? The Joker trailer has a confidence about it in its marketing and everything where it's like, we don't need to show you a lot. We can give you just the basics because we feel like we have a strong product here. When you get this type of trailer where it's like, we're pretty much showing you everything. You know, it's like those comedy trailers where you know like every joke you just saw in the trailer.
Yeah.
Like it's like, we don't really have a lot of confidence in our product, so we're going to give you as much as we can to just try to convince you that this is cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
So something that is cool that is coming out this weekend is It Chapter 2.
Yeah.
Right? So the first It was a gigantic success, surprise, right? Success. And this movie's projected to do over $100 million at the box office opening weekend, be a huge hit. And the reviews are starting to trickle in. It's right now, we're recording this on Tuesday, September 3rd. It is like 75 reviews in, and it's sitting at like 79%. On Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, I'm kind of pumped for this. Now, I'm a big fan of It, the book, the original miniseries, TV series, miniseries. I did not love the first one. I was in the minority. I thought it was okay.
Mm.
I just feel like the not having the back and forth going, you know, from when they were children to adults takes something away from the story because I feel like the parallels there were a big part of the story.
Mm.
So I think that they are going to start incorporating some of those elements, though, into this.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to go back and forth a little bit. It's a heck of a cast. I still can't believe the cast they put together for this.
Right.
But I guess that's what happens when your movie makes as much money as the first one did. I mean, is this something that's on your radar right now? Or
of course.
Are you going to go?
Yeah.
Is this a first weekend deal for you? Or?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure that out. So Jess and I were just talking about it before we started recording, but I was like, yeah, I got to go see this. And we don't necessarily have a babysitter, so she wants to see it. And I'm like, well, when are we going to go see it together? And she's like, yeah. So I'm like, yeah, so I'll be there opening night. I'm going to go see it on Friday. Maybe not opening night. Maybe opening morning or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
But I'm super stoked to see it. I did see some of the reviews that dropped, like Hollywood Reporter dropped theirs, and I think Variety also dropped theirs. I kind of quickly went over it. And once I read something that's a little negative, like when they start adding some like, you know, hyperbolic snark into it, I'm like, I'm done. I'm not reading this anymore. But yeah, either way, I was going to see it. So, cause I really enjoyed the first chapter. So
okay.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And so that's going to do well. And, you know, the summer box office, we're going to talk about Phil's question now. So,
mm-hmm.
He said, you know, the summer box office was slightly down this year. Is this an indicator of a shift in the audience consumption habits, or was it just a bad crop of summer flicks? So we kind of touched on this a little bit already,
yeah,
like before. But yeah, I find it hard to believe that people don't want to go to movies anymore or have other ways to watch movies when, you know, something like Avengers Endgame happens, right? Or
right.
Even the Disney films that came out this year, or
right.
Spider-Man
right.
Homecoming, Spider-Man Far From Home. Like, it's just that this summer was the summer of, like, the haves and the have-nots, right? It was the summer
right.
of extremes. There weren't a lot of those, like, middle-of-the-road movies. It was, you know, you had your billion-dollar-plus films, right? So your Endgame, and you're Far From Home and the, you know, Aladdin and Toy Story 4 and The Lion King. And then you had, you know, a lot of your movies like Dark Phoenix and Men in Black International, which mm-hmm. in a different time, they probably would have done much better, just, you know, even with the reviews that they had. They probably would have done much better just because of habit, right? People would have gone anyway because they were a franchise film. See, that's what I think has changed. Right. I think now people are just not going to flock to something just because it's part of a franchise.
Right.
You know, because they do expect a certain amount of quality, kind of, at least for established stuff. If it's new, like, so something like a Venom, for instance, right? It's kind of a new thing. So that wound up being review proof. But like something like Dark Phoenix, like, you have a history there. And you're coming off of a movie that was already pretty terrible. Right? So, mm-hmm. and Men in Black International, kind of the same type of deal. You know, like, it's a franchise that people weren't really clamoring for. So, I think that's what you're seeing. But, you know, there were movies that were kind of middle of the road. So, like, your movies like John Wick Chapter 3 and like, Hobbs and Shaw, those are movies that did really well, right, relative to their genres.
Right.
But, like, you know, they're not, you know, I don't know. Like, those were, like, your
second tier films. Well, their audiences are different, too, you know what I mean? Like, that's going to skew a certain direction. I think the problem with this season in particular is that every, like, Men in Black, Avengers, I'd say maybe some of these Disney films, they're still vying for the same dollars of the same general audience. Like, so they're gonna pick and choose between, like, what they want to see and what they don't want to see. And if you're kind of like a middle of the road blockbuster, there's like, the quality is like, meh, I'm not gonna go see it. I'll save my money and go see something else that I'm absolutely want to see. So I think we had a little bit of that. Your point about the audience's taste towards franchises is a damn good one, because you just can't do it. You can't go off of, like, oh yeah, we're tried and true, when you're really not, and you haven't actually been around for a little while.
No, yeah, I mean, there was a while there where, and I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing that audiences are no longer just falling for the whole, like, oh, well, we know what that is.
Right.
It's X-Men. Oh, it's Men in Black. Oh, it's good. Right. People are, you know, they almost have that, like, impress me, bro mentality, you know, like, mm-hmm. a little bit. Yeah, there are still going to be movies that don't get great reviews that do well at the box office. But again, it's got to be, if it's something a little fresher, right, a little newer. The idea of trying to resurrect a franchise that, you know, people haven't been clamoring for, like, and just to keep tacking on, like, those days are over now. Those quote-unquote cash grabs are quite the opposite now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. Like, we're all better off for that, because we don't need Dark Phoenixes, and we don't need Men in Black Internationals.
Or Terminator Dark Phoenix.
Or, yeah, well, we'll see about that one. But, yeah, I mean, I think that... yeah, so I just think that this summer was kind of underwhelming as far as there just wasn't a lot of things. Like, you know, Godzilla King of the Monsters, right? So that was a disappointment. And that was something that people, you know, had high hopes for. Yeah, I mean, I don't think habits are changing that much. I think if anything, going to the movies now has been kind of resurrected in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, Marvel, the MCU, has helped that, because it made, you know, going to the movies an event, and Disney has helped that a lot, because they keep cranking out these event films.
Right.
And that's what's going to get people to the theater, right? Because
you're going to feel like you don't want to miss out on.
Exactly. You don't want to miss out. You have to be there opening, because everyone's going to be talking about it. You want to see it on the big screen, right? You don't want to watch it at home. It's not the same experience. So, you know, it's all about getting people to go to the theater. So, yeah, it's expensive to go to the movies now, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it has been for a while, but it's really expensive. So you kind of have to pick and choose, and you have to give people a reason to say, I can't wait for Netflix, or I can't wait for it to come out on, you know, to be available on to rent. You know, at home. Like, I need to go to the theater to see this and experience this. And you're going to do that with an event type of film. So, yeah, I think you're seeing a resurgence now because going to the movies is cool again because of the superhero. It's not just Marvel, but because of the superhero genre, and Star Wars being revitalized, you know, and stuff like that, that I think that people are going back to the theaters. It's just that they're, you can't have something like that all the time.
Yeah. You know? And you have to, I think you have to strategically place them, right, in terms of release, because
yes, and that's the other factor.
Yeah, you can't just say, oh, you know, this is a, this has blockbuster like qualities, I'm just going to drop it in the middle of the summer,
yeah,
when it's competing against some, sure, of these behemoth films, yes, these cultural momentum films. It's like, yeah, not going to happen.
The other thing too, as we've mentioned, is that the timing, right? Movies now come, mm-hmm, out all year round. Blockbuster potential films.
Right.
So the summer isn't as important as it used to be.
Right.
You know, so you're going to get movies that come out in February, in March, that do big numbers. You're going to get movies now that, look, I mean, we just talked about what, you know, It Chapter 2 coming out September 6th, and it's projected to be bigger than any movie that came out in August.
Right.
And maybe even July. You know, I mean, it's going to do big numbers in September 6th. The movies that came out September 6th years ago would never have had a shot. Right. To do that. And yeah. October 6th is Joker. And we assume that's going to do really well, too, right? So,
mm-hmm,
I mean, these are times that movies never came out that were worth anything.
Yeah.
So we're seeing that now. It's an all-year-round thing. And, you know, so that's part of it, too. So in the past, you know, when you're just looking at the summer, you know, a movie like Joker, a movie like It Chapter 2, like those movies, based on their pedigrees, might have come out in the summer. You know, mm-hmm, rather than hold them off. You know, a movie like Avengers Endgame, you know, maybe that one comes out in June and Captain Marvel comes out towards the end of April, and they all are considered summer movies. You know, so like, but they don't have to do that anymore because it doesn't matter when you release it. You can release a Avengers movie at the end of April and it's going to do $2.8 billion. You know, you can release a Captain Marvel movie in March. You could release Black Panther in February. You can do It and Joker in September and October.
Right.
And last year, Venom, you know, in October. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't make a difference anymore. You know, when, I mean, I think it can make a difference when you release a film, can dictate. I think there are good times and bad times to release certain films.
Sure.
But I,
sure,
think when you're looking at like overall box office and you're just looking at just the summer, it could also be, well, let's take a look at the year as a whole. It, mm-hmm, maybe it's just there were movies that came out in and around, you know, the summer that were bigger hits than maybe in previous years, but the actual summer season may have been a little bit down. But as a yearly thing, that might tell a different story. So
yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. And sticking on this topic for a second, get to our final question here from JRB. He says, without cheating, try to guess the top three grossing directors of all time. So I resisted the urge to not do any research on this because I was fascinated by this question.
And yeah,
I've been thinking about it all day. You know, this is tough because, like, are we talking about, like, we're not adjusting for inflation? Because that changes a lot, right? I mean,
yeah, I don't think we should.
So, right. So if you take it, for instance, like a guy like Spielberg, right, who I would think, right, would come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the volume of films and the fact that a lot of his films have done really well. But, like, a lot of his stuff came out, like his biggest blockbusters came out at a time when the numbers aren't going to compare.
Right.
I mean, they were amazing in their day, right? But they're not necessarily going to compare, especially worldwide. You know,
right.
I mean, international markets, when, you know, the Indiana Jones movies came out, were nothing. You know, so like it's hard to compare those. You know, you look at a guy like a George Lucas right now. He directed A New Hope. He didn't direct Empire Strikes Back. He didn't direct Return of the Jedi.
Right.
He did direct all three of the prequel trilogy and hasn't directed any of these modern films.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he had a movie like American Graffiti before that, which was a hit in its time. But again, those numbers aren't going to compare to things now. You know, what's funny, I was thinking of the Russo brothers.
Yep.
Because now they're not that's not something that jumps right out at you, right? Now these guys have only directed,
I think they're number one.
Well, they've only directed four films,
mm-hmm,
in their career. and they happen to be Captain America, Winter Soldier, and Civil War, and then the two, you know, Avengers, Infinity War, and Endgame.
Billion, two billion.
Well, I mean, their movies have made like over $6 billion, the four of them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's absurd. But you wouldn't necessarily think of them because, one, they haven't directed a lot, and two, you know, they're part of like that Marvel machine where the directors oftentimes don't get the credit
right
for their work. Right.
So I think they're at the top.
I would think so. Right.
Yeah.
Again, I just because of like the time, the timing of it. I don't know how, you know, you're looking at the biggest directors, right, who made the biggest films.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of those types of directors are made their movies years ago.
Right.
When the numbers aren't going to be able to compare.
Yeah.
Because look at James Cameron, right? I mean, he had Avatar. So Avatar was the box office champ, right?
Right.
And we know Titanic, made a ton of money. Those numbers still translate today.
Right.
But, you know, like a Terminator 2, those numbers were great in their day, but they're not going to, you know, I mean, they're not going to jump out at you comparatively. And the original Terminator was more like a sleeper kind of hit. Like
it, and then True Lies.
True Lies, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I would think he's got to be.
I'd say Russo Brothers number one, James Cameron number two. I was struggling with number three. It could be Spielberg.
I mean, I'm just thinking maybe because of just the volume, right? Of
volume. But then, you know, is Christopher Nolan in this running?
Oh well, there you go. Because he's got the Dark Knight trilogy,
right? Interstellar. Well, I mean, Interstellar. I don't think. I'm not looking at anything, by the way, right now.
Oh, I no. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, so Interstellar, but then the Prestige. I would Inception. I'm thinking these would have done okay.
Yeah, Dunkirk. I mean, I don't think they. Yeah, I mean, his biggest films, obviously, by far, are the Dark Knight,
right? The Batman films, well, the last two. So Spielberg would, in my mind, would be up there because of volume, but then nothing of his is really cracking a billion, which is a game changer. Really,
and I
right?
mean, I don't know. The other thing too is for this question is: are we talking worldwide or are we talking domestic? Because a lot of directors, you know, made movies at the international box office didn't become a huge thing until kind of
recent.
I mean, I'll say recent. It's not like a couple of years, but it's been maybe within the last 10 years, 12 years or so. Like it's really became a big, because even when the MCU first started, like the international markets were not quite what they are now.
Right.
I don't know what we're looking at.
I mean, if we were to Google it right now.
All right, let's
see. Let's do it.
Top grossing worldwide. Okay, so here we go. This is, I don't know how recent this is, but this is the list that I have now. Now, so they unfortunately, okay, this has to be recent. So now they, so number one is Steven Spielberg. 36 movies, worldwide box office gross $10.5 billion, an average gross of $293 million per movie. So again, with him, it's a lot of volume. Right?
Right.
Now, they broke up the Russo brothers individually, so for them, two and three are Joe Russo and Anthony Russo, but they're one entity, right? It's the same thing. So we're going to lump them in as two. They are $6.828 billion over... Now, it says six movies, so I guess they directed a couple of other movies that we missed that didn't make a lot of money because... but their average movie gross.
Oh, you mean Dupree? Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. Yep. Yeah. All right. All right. Well, whatever. So the majority of their films came from, but their average is $1.14 billion per movie.
Damn.
That's not bad. And that counts you, me, and Dupree and whatever else they did before, or with the Winter Soldier. And then number three is Peter Jackson.
Who I'm probably, so mad I missed Peter
yes,
Jackson.
Well, I'm mad we missed three and four because James Cameron's actually number five. So three is Peter Jackson, $6.5 billion. His average is 13 movies, his average. Now, of course, he made a lot of those early films.
Right.
Like, you know, Dead Alive and stuff like that. But 13 movies, $505 million average. Michael Bay,
oh,
we should have probably guessed, for better or for worse, Michael Bay.
Yeah.
15 movies, $6.44 billion, $429.5 million average. And then James Cameron, $6.2 million. 14 movies, a $445 million average. So based on average, you got the Russos way ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
Did a lot less movies, but still. And then Peter Jackson, and then James Cameron. And actually ahead of James
Freaking
Cameron.
David Yates.
Ahead of James Cameron would have been Jon Favreau on the average per movie. And, yeah. So, yeah, David Yates. Well, that's those Harry Potter films, right?
Yeah,
he's that
man.
Guy. Yeah. Oh, Chris, there's Christopher Nolan. So David Yates is almost $6 billion, eight films. And James Cameron, Christopher Nolan, $4.7
million. Wow.
You mentioned him before. Yeah, this is fascinating. I'm going to keep going down this. I mean, I'm not going to on the show go down the rest of the list, but I'm going to look through this. This is really good.
I mean, these are the
stuff. There's a lot
the
of big
franchise,
names
the franchise guys here.
Yeah.
You know, like Gore Verbinski.
Yeah.
For Pirates films.
Yep. Yep. Oh, that right. makes sense, right? I mean, you're going to, you know, you need those in order to get to be on. I mean, look at the Russos, obviously. Like, they've made six films. Four of them were Marvel films, and that those four were six and a half plus $1 billion, almost $6.6 billion out of their $6.8 billion total came from those four films.
Right.
You know, even a guy like Cameron, I mean, look, he's $6.2 billion, but 2.7 of that comes from, almost half of that comes from Avatar.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. I mean,
all you need is a hit.
That's, well, yeah, a massive hit that makes almost $3 billion. Sure, it helps.
Yeah,
it helps to be a good director, too. I mean, that doesn't explain Michael Bay, but he's tacked on to some franchises and made a bunch of event films. So, anyway,
Zack
great
Snyder's
question.
On this list.
Well, yeah, but again, he's made, you know,
yeah, he's made some movies. Made some money.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. There's a lot of people on this. This is a very robust list, but that was an excellent question. And I'm still disappointed we didn't guess Peter Jackson, but I was thinking,
I'm so mad at myself for that.
Yeah.
But we did have, we had Spielberg.
And the Russos.
And the Russos.
Yeah.
So, all right. Not bad.
All right. Not too bad.
Pretty good.
So, all right. On that note, we can get on out of here. Of course, you can visit thefanboygarage.com. Check out our episodes, buy some merch in the merch store. Leave us an email if you don't do the social media stuff. Smoke signals, yeah. Write us a letter. If you do the social media stuff, of course, you can join the conversation on Twitter at The Fanboy Garage. Of course, on our Facebook page, The Fanboy Garage. And individually, you can find me on Twitter at RealCLMighty.
And you can find me on Twitter at Starting Sith. We will be at New York Comic Con on October 6th. So please, October 6th and 7th, I'm sorry. So please, if you're in the area and you've got your tickets, please check us out. Hoping to link up with our friends from Batman on Film. And maybe we'll do something. I don't know. But in the meantime, thank you guys so much for listening. And we'll catch you on the next one.